Auhea o kou e kou ka aha. Inā he kuleana i mua o kea aha ho'okolo kolo kie kie hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoe mai, e malio mai, i lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho i lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-17-701, State versus Boudet Close. Arguing for the petitioner, Victor M. Cox. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen L. Fry. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Mr. Cox and Mr. Fry. Are you both ready to proceed today? Okay. Mr. Cox, you've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so the warning light come on with 10 minutes of your argument, and Mr. Fry will give you a 5-minute warning, so please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice. First, on behalf of the defendant, thank you for taking this case for consideration.
If you could move the microphone just a little closer, then I'd be able to.
Is that better?
Yes, it is. Okay.
Sorry. First, I'd like to point out that there has been no response to the application for writ of certiorari by the state. Also, in the state's answering brief, there is no mention, no comment, and no authority citing or referencing the failure of the trial court to engage in the balancing act for the determining whether the offered evidence was prejudicial, more prejudicial than probative. And that's an item, an act, that has been clearly indicated to be in the domain of the trial court, and it's something that they must do on the record.
Recognizing that that's a best practice or encouraged, and certainly recognizing it should happen, but are there any cases that specifically hold those factors have to be mentioned explicitly by the trial?
I know there's a case that refers to that the practice should be to place it on the record.
Are you aware of any, I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Cox, but are you aware of any cases in which 403 has been applied to determine that evidence that has been admitted in violation of a defendant's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination is evidence that is so probative that it justifies its admission?
I'm not aware of a case that determined that, even if it was determined to be less probative than prejudicial, it still might be admitted. I'm not aware of a case that says that.
In other words, does probativeness at some point justify a constitutional violation of the right against self-incrimination?
I don't know of a case that says that. I think my answer to that would be that it's still up to the trial court to make that determination. Otherwise, the ICA or you folks won't know how that trial court arrived at their decision and or whether that was an abuse of discretion, which is the test for whether the trial judge did what he or she was supposed to do.
Mr. Cox, do you think it's problematic that no objection was made either at the voluntariness hearing or at the admission of the statement by the defendant, except for the 403? And as a matter of fact, the defense attorney said he didn't view it, but regardless of whether that was the original or a copy. But is there a problem with that? No objection was made on constitutional grounds until after the, even though there was a voluntariness hearing, until after the evidence was admitted?
If I understand the question, I think my answer would be twofold. The admission of the statement at the voluntariness hearing would have been under a different standard of proof, and I'm not clear as to whether that's a preponderance or a stronger burden, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt burden at the voluntariness hearing.
The admission of a statement is beyond a reasonable doubt? I'm not following what you're stating.
Well, I cited a case, and I think it was a California case, that indicated that there is, at least in that jurisdiction, a different standard of proof for evidence to be admitted at a hearing to determine voluntariness of the statement. And it, whether it was objected to or not at the voluntariness hearing, I do not know. But it was objected to at the time of the trial on 403, and that he hadn't had, that the defense attorney hadn't had a chance to review that particular statement. And there's nothing in the record indicating or showing that the statement that was offered at the trial was the exact same statement that was offered at the voluntariness hearing. So,
Mr. Cox, could I ask your view about this moment at the trial where there's a voluntariness hearing being held per statute, right? The statute requires a voluntariness hearing to determine whether statements of the defendant are going to be admitted. It's also, I think, undisputed that the burden to show voluntariness is on what party?
I believe it's on the state.
It's on the state. And what I wanted to ask you about is the point that this court made in Lau versus Allied Wholesale, that before a judge makes a decision on admissibility of a recording, that it's recommended that the judge look at it. So given that proposition, do you think that in this context, which has to do with the right to the right against self-incrimination and the statutory provision, that that right be protected by a voluntariness hearing, do you think that once the defendant objected to the statement, at least, that there should be a duty on the part of the court to review the statement?
I do, yeah. I do believe that, and I think I cited a case that indicates that that would be the responsibility of the court once the statement is offered to review it before publishing it to the jury.
Is there anything to indicate? I thought you had said that the record showed that it was the same CD that had been the subject of the voluntary.
No, the record does not show that. It does not show that.
The state thinks it does. You think there's nothing to show that. Is that correct?
I'm sorry? The record does not establish that they're the same, and there's nothing in the trial court record showing that somebody said from the state or the judge or anybody else that said, yes, this is the same statement we used at the voluntary hearing. There's no such thing appears in the record. And so that was why the argument was made that, well, wait a second, defense counsel didn't get a chance to review that statement, the one that was being offered, and the court didn't review it. Well, I guess my response would be twofold. He did object on 403, which would have required the court to at least review it and determine whether its prejudicial value, which would include whether or not he had made an admission that was constitutionally protected. And number two, plain error.
Isn't there a third response? First of all, the voluntariness hearing determines voluntariness, number one. And number two, what occurred at trial, even if the defendant makes, and even assuming that the defendant was tardy in bringing up the objection, he did bring it up, or she, counsel brought it up as a motion for mistrial after the statement had been elicited. So the court could have stricken the statement and told the jury to disregard it. And we presume generally that juries follow cautionary instructions. So the untimeliness or the waiver issue, I'm not sure. This isn't the case where it was brought up after trial. Trial was still ongoing. This wouldn't be no different than a witness blurting out something and the 404 matter, for example, and the defense counsel saying, Judge, that shouldn't have been admitted. I move to strike it, and I move for a cautionary instruction. Is that any different than what occurred here?
Well, I think it's different from the standpoint that that's not before the jury, and it's also there's no showing that even at the motion that I'm aware of, at the motion for reconsideration, that even then the court took the time to make the balancing act. So,
can you explain, Mr. Cox, in light of what the statement of the defendant was, which was not that I don't want to get into that situation about the not, but he was afraid to go there. The defendant's friends were there. I'm afraid to go there. Why is the admission of that statement not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Why is it not what?
Why is it not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, I guess two answers again. I think that exact same situation or a situation that's almost identical came up in this case of Heard versus Terhune. That's the 619 F3.
Wasn't the reason for him not wanting to reenact it different from the reason here? This guy isn't saying, oh, it's complicated, you know, like it's a difficult situation to describe, but this person is expressing fear from who's going to be there, that area where the victim's friends hang out.
You're so talking about the person in the Heard case?
No, that's in the present case.
Well, in this case,
that's his reason. In Heard, it's more of a, I don't want to pin myself down as to what happened, but in this case, it was a fear of going to that site.
Well, my response would be that I think the result is the same. It's the same result of invoking your constitutional right to remain silent. And I think that that's shown by the officers, the interrogating officer's response after that exchange about, I'm not comfortable going there to do that. The investigating officer says, I have no further questions. So I think it's arguably clear that the officer understood that he was invoking his right at that time.
And I wanted to ask your thoughts in that regard and talks about harmless error. There is a statement by the testifying officer, I think it's Officer Mao, in which he gives his viewpoint about the evidence. Correct me if I misstate the record, but it appears that he actually testifies that he didn't see any evidence of the knife at the scene and in his investigation. So if you consider that you have the officer giving his opinion, then wouldn't it mean that the failure of the defendant to cooperate by reenacting the scene takes on more importance because you've already had the officer tell the jury that didn't seem to me there was any evidence of a knife?
Well, I guess the response is I don't think that changes the conclusion that he invoked his constitutional right to remain silent, which is the same to me, almost identical to the Heard case of the circumstances where the guy says, you know, I'm not going to do that.
Well, the mere fact that, you know, his right against self-incrimination was violated, of course, is something that probably you could say very, very much mirrors Heard. But looking at the facts of Heard and the facts here, it seemed that in terms of deciding how much difference this arguably inadmissible evidence had, how much difference it made to the jury's determination in applying harmless standard. I was just considering whether the difference was even greater in this case. That is the difference when the inadmissible evidence was allowed before the jury, because you'd had prior to that the detective saying that the defendant's statement didn't make any sense, that he was never able to, the detective said he was never able to corroborate Badeau Close's assertion that Ault had brandished a knife. And then he actually said there was no knife involved. So it sort of raises the importance, maybe, of a reenactment. And if the jury knows that, you know, the defendant refused to do a reenactment, with this issue having been raised by the detective, it would seem like perhaps that was an issue that was on their mind. That was my point. But I don't know. Is that an accurate statement of the record? Or?
Well, I can't actually tell you if that's actually what happened in the record either, but my answer would be that to me it doesn't change the fact that he invoked his constitutional right and that was played before the jury. So if there's a section or a point and the judge reviews this recorded statement and he or she reaches a conclusion that, okay, this part is admissible, but the part where he says, no, I'm not comfortable doing that, he invoked his constitutional right, that you can't put that before the jury because it's prejudicial. So maybe the part you're talking about gets in, but that would be up to the trial court judge after reviewing the full statement and making his or her delicate balancing act.
Mr. Cox, you're right in that Heard seems to say that, or does say that, refusing to reenact a scene is an invocation of a right to remain silent, but that Heard was never brought to the attention of the trial court.
Yes, it was.
What, it was in the motion? Heard was?
It was brought, the prosecutor mentioned it in court. But so my argument was that, yes, the prosecutor mentioned it, but in this case, they went way beyond mentioning it. They showed the whole statement to the jury.
The Heard, the case Heard was brought to the court's attention in what, at the motion for mistrial?
In this case, was the Heard case brought at
yes,
the motion
the
for
trial
mistrial?
Courts.
Oh, I don't believe so.
As a matter of fact, you didn't bring it to the attention until certiorari, right? It wasn't brought to the attention of the ICA either.
I don't believe so.
So it's persuasive authority, and it's a 2010 case. So is that problematic that when you have a case that's persuasive, you don't tell the judge about it? Not you, but the trial attorney didn't tell the judge about it.
I guess it's an issue, and maybe he should have done that, and maybe if I had known all of that before, and maybe there was a failure of counsel to do his job, but I don't think it changes the situation right now, and this case being strikingly similar to the Heard case and also to the situation in the Domingo State versus Domingo case about the harmless error was what was raised earlier, is that if there's any kind of a reasonable possibility in a criminal case that the error might have contributed to the conviction, then it's...
That's an interesting issue when you compare Heard, where the prosecutor repeatedly... comments of the prosecutor were extensive and stressed an inference of guilt, repeatedly stressed his silence. So the nature of what happened is something that the court should take into account. That didn't happen here, did it? The prosecutor didn't appear to stress that the defendant was somehow disingenuous or showing consciousness of guilt by refusing to go to the scene, did they?
Not that I'm aware of, but the answer back would be, again, if the jury has shown a video of the defendant saying, I don't want to cooperate with the police. To me, that's just as prejudicial.
Well, he didn't say that, right? I mean, he cooperated. And as a matter of fact, his statement, although it was ostensibly about self-defense, he admitted punching and kicking the victim in the face. So the fact that later on he said, well, you know, I don't want to go down there because the victim's friends hang out there and I might be attacked, you know, showed fear. Is that harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, then? Because he admitted that he kicked him in the face.
Well,
and the only reason he didn't want to go there was because of friends of the complaining witness.
I understand that there's some damaging testimony or damaging evidence in his statement. I don't dispute that. But it still doesn't change the fact that he made a statement that, under my interpretation of the case law, invoked his constitutional right to remain silent, and that should not have been presented to the jury. And whether that's a tipping point or not, I don't know, but I certainly think that it's a reasonable possibility that might have led to the conviction of attempted murder versus assault. So, and if that's the case, then I think he's entitled to a new trial.
What standard do you suggest that we, I'm assuming you are asking us to hold based on the Hawaii Constitution and not based on the federal Constitution?
Yes. Sure.
And what standard are you? Do you suggest that we apply in situations like this? In the Burgess versus Thompson case, which was referred to in Heard, the United States Supreme Court said that there's a good reason to require an accused who wants to invoke his right to remain silent to do so unambiguously. A requirement of an unambiguous invocation of Miranda rights results in an objective inquiry that avoids difficulties of proof and provides guidance to officers on how to proceed in the face of an ambiguity. And it was actually citing back to the Davis case. So are you suggesting we apply that standard under the Hawaii Constitution?
Well, I'm not clear what the standard you're referring to, but my understanding.
Well, you know, you're indicating that your client's statements that, you know, I'm scared and I'm not comfortable with that invoked his right to remain silent.
Correct.
Right. And so
I think that one.
Do you agree that we should adopt the United States Supreme Court's standard of unambiguous assertion of the right to remain silent? And if so, I assume your argument is that that unambiguous standard was met in this case?
I think the court should adopt the unambiguous statement standard, but I don't think I think it was met in this case that that's what happened. And so to me, that constitutional issue is a right-wrong standard.
Right. I understand. I'm just trying to figure out, because I don't think we've ever ruled on this type of selective assertion of the right to remain silent. I couldn't find any specific cases. Are there any specific Hawaii cases on the selective right, the right to selectively assert the right to remain silent?
None other than what I've cited. I don't know of any.
Well, in any event, Miranda is very clear, as Heard points out, that Miranda allows this.
I think it would be the same as the federal, since the statutes are almost identical. The evidentiary rules of evidence are almost identical to the federal ones. So the other standard question, I don't know if this is part of your question or not, but I'm not clear, frankly, on what to apply to the judge's failure to do the balancing act. I know if he had done the balancing act, then it would be an abuse of discretion whether he did it correctly or not. But since that was never accomplished.
But are we talking about the assertion of the right to remain silent here?
No, I'm talking about the admission of the other evidence, yeah.
Okay.
What is it about the invocation of his right to not want to participate in the reenactment? You said that could possibly have led to his conviction for attempted murder instead of assault. Why? What is that connection? Why would his invocation lead to his conviction of murder, attempted murder?
Well, I guess my answer to that is that it's the State versus Domingo case, 69 Hawaii 68, where the court says that a very similar case, the defendant was charged with either manslaughter or murder. and there was an error in admission of evidence, and the court said that there's a reasonable possibility that had that evidence not been admitted, that the defendant might have been convicted of manslaughter instead of murder, or his self-defense argument been accepted. So that's the connection to me, is that it has a bearing on what the severity of the conviction might be.
What about the Reeves case where the court went through an analysis of how the evidence was put before the jury, what the manner in which it was done or commented on, and the impact on the case? Have you looked at that case?
I have not.
Well, anything further at this time? I want to reserve your time and come back on rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Very well. We'll hear from Mr. Fry.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, thank you for the opportunity to argue before you today. With respect to the 403 balancing test that was done on the brothers of the victim's testimony, as well as the pools of blood, there was brief argument on that, on whether or not the trial court, if there were any cases that mandated the trial court to conduct an on-the-record balancing test. And it's important in this case to remember that there were no motions in limine that were filed relating to the evidence. These objections that were done by trial counsel, he stated objection 403. It put the trial court in a position where it either could sustain or overrule the objection, but the jury was impaneled, and if a balancing test was going to be conducted, it would have to be done in a sidebar, not in the presence of the jury.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can you help me with that? You're having a voluntariness hearing that's close to the beginning of trial, right?
Yes.
Now, who schedules a voluntariness hearing?
The state.
Well, and it's put on the court's calendar, right?
Correct.
Was there any reason why the voluntariness hearing couldn't have been conducted earlier? In other words, like a day before, a week before?
I believe in this case the voluntariness was conducted substantially in advance of trial.
Okay, so you have a voluntariness hearing in which there's an objection made. I thought you were making the point that the court had to do a sidebar. The court didn't have much time to make a decision on the voluntariness hearing.
No, the evidence, I believe the evidence that is brought up on appeal are the two photographs of the pools of blood that were objected to on 403 grounds at trial, as well as the testimony of Luke Ault.
I thought you were going to the statement that had been given to the jury that was part of the voluntariness hearing.
No.
Okay.
That statement was also objected on 403 grounds, but I'm not. I wasn't intending to address the statement under advice of rights. I was just speaking to the other.
Okay.
Testimony.
Well, you're welcome to go ahead then with the other evidence that you're referring to. I thought you were talking about the statement. Sorry.
There was a question from the court on whether there was any precedent on whether the court had to conduct an on-the-record balancing test, and in appellant's application for writ of certiorari, he cited to a Ninth Circuit case in which it indicated that the best practice is to conduct that on-the-record balancing test. In that case is about prior sexual misconduct in an evidence of a sex assault case. So the court indicated that it was highly prejudicial, but they still had to do the balancing test. So you have evidence that a motion in limine is filed, there's a pretrial determination, and the court is going to go through that balancing test so that the issue is reserved for appeal properly. But this is not the case in the case before the court today. You have objections that are made during the course of trial, and the trial judge made his decision, and there's no reason to depart from the abuse of discretion standard in reviewing how that evidence was received. So you have two photos of pools of blood that comes in very early at trial. There's no issue of accumulation of similar evidence at that point. Those were accepted in the first day of trial and the second witness. There were no other photos of pools of blood. And the ICA indicated that there's other case precedent for other more gruesome photos. So that's doesn't seem the photos in question to in this case are not so overly prejudicial that the trial court should be deemed to have abused his discretion in admitting that. Same for the testimony of the victim's brother. The victim's brother had evidence to give of the victim's previous condition before the assault. That goes to the charge of assault in the first degree, goes to protracted impairment, it goes to loss of bodily function, certainly issues that needed to be presented by the court or needed to be presented by the state.
Could we focus on the other issue? And how do you distinguish Heard?
Heard is very distinguishable. Heard is a case in which there were pretrial motions that discussed the admissibility of that evidence because the defendant in that case declined to participate in a reenactment. And the Heard court discusses in great detail the number of times the prosecution was attempting to use that to argue against the defendant, saying that he was culpable because he failed to participate in that reenactment. And that's certainly not present in this case.
Are you then conceding that there was a violation from the point of view of his right against self-incrimination and arguing harmless error? Is this what you're arguing?
If I think there, in this case, and it's important to note that there is an argument on whether or not there was a definitive invocation of the right to remain silent. If there was, then I would ask the court to conduct the harmless error analysis. But it's still not clear whether or not the defendant in this case clearly invoked his right to remain silent. And one of the reasons that it's not clear...
Because Justice McKenna asked you about distinguishing Heard, and so far it sounds like, with respect to Heard, you are... if you're not conceding that it's on point, I'm still interested in your response to Justice McKenna's question. Why wouldn't it be on point with respect to the violation of the defendant's right against self-incrimination in this case?
Heard is on point if the court gets to the point where they determine that there was invocation of the defendant's right to remain silent. If that is concluded, and I believe there's a question prior, are there any cases where the right to remain silent is so probative that the court would admit that evidence? And I don't think that's the case.
All right, you don't think that's the case. Well, let's kind of turn to the facts here. You have a individual who is in a coercive atmosphere, right, being questioned.
Yes.
And he's told that you don't have to continue to answer the questions. That's part of the advisement of rights, right?
Yes.
Then he's asked to do a reenactment. Now, if we look to Heard, Heard decided he wasn't going to do a reenactment. Here, the defendant decided whether he was going to do a reenactment, the record seems to indicate. Didn't he? Wasn't he asked to do a reenactment?
He was.
And didn't he decline to do a reenactement?
He did decline, but he also...
There you go. Well, how much more do you need?
The distinction between this case and Heard is the use of the evidence against the defendant. Arguably, defense counsel wanted that statement to come in. It was in line with the defense case. The defendant was saying he was scared. He was saying he acted in self-defense, not wanting to go back to the scene shortly after the scene because there were possibility of the victim's friends in the area.
What about the motion for mistrial?
Was that a sham? Is that what you're arguing? I mean, I don't follow that the defense counsel wanted it to come in if the defense counsel makes a motion for mistrial.
The motion for mistrial was made after the evidence came in. And there's questions in this case on whether or not defense counsel knew what the statement was. This was the same advice of rights recording that was admitted at the motion to determine voluntariness. It was provided to defense counsel in discovery.
Well, now that's
what the statement was.
You disagree. Mr. Cox disagrees. Your position is the record shows that this was the same recording, or is that ambiguous?
The recording was admitted at the motion to determine voluntariness. The recording was also admitted at trial. The record will speak for itself. That if the court can review the motion to determine voluntariness evidence and the evidence that was admitted at trial, it's the same disk.
Mr. Fry, you were starting to say why you thought that the invocation to remain silent was unclear. Can you finish your thoughts on that?
Because the defendant in this case, he didn't say, I don't want to cooperate with the police further. In Rodriguez, that was the issue. You have a advice or right statement that's occurring, then the defendant in that case is asked to have that statement recorded, and he says, no, I don't want to have it recorded, and that terminates the interview at that point. And the court in Rodriguez stated that, looking at the facts in that case, and Rodriguez looks at a Nebraska case and they look at a Maryland case to determine if timing is an issue. And in the Rodriguez case, when they look at, I believe it's Webb from Maryland, similar fact pattern was a defendant is being interviewed, declines the interview to be recorded, but then goes ahead and makes a voluntary statement. So there's, along the same analysis, there's a defendant that doesn't want his statement to be recorded. Is that an invocation of a defendant's right to remain silent? It's certainly not full cooperation with police. But there's evidence that they want to go forward and make statements. In this case, there's evidence that the defendant wanted to go forward, he wanted to make statements. He wanted to tell the officers why he didn't want to go back to the scene.
Okay. I'm sorry, Justice Pollack.
I'd like to follow up with what Justice McKenna asked earlier. And I think the phrase she used was selective invocation or something along that line with selective. And the question was, does a defendant have a right to, when they waive Miranda, to say, look, if they're asked about certain questions and they say, look, I am not going to discuss questions about that specific subject matter, okay? But I'll speak to you about other things. Can the police then use the invocation of the right to silence as a particular subject matter against the defendant?
I would say that they can't. And selective, I believe Justice McKenna was possibly inquiring about a difference in selective right to remain silent, because in this case, he didn't say that I don't want to answer a particular question. He was asked to engage in a reenactment, and he gave a reason why he didn't want to engage in that reenactment. It's not really saying no. It's saying why he doesn't want to do it.
What difference does it make what his reason is? I mean, if he says, look, I don't want to do a reenactment, or I don't want to do a reenactment because of A, B, and C, the bottom line is he doesn't want to do reenactment, and that response should have been excluded and redacted from what the jury should have heard, at least from what the defendant is arguing.
Correct, and I think that goes to whether or not declining to do something is a clear invocation of the defendant's right to remain silent, and I don't think that's clear. The court at the ICA concluded that this wasn't a clear invocation of a defendant's right to remain silent. He said he didn't want to participate in a reenactment, but he continued to make statements. And there's
a reenactment? It's your argument that a reenactment of a crime is not a statement?
It is. Okay. A reenactment is. And it's clear, the defendant in this case declined to participate in that.
So if we assume that if there had been a proper objection, that the portion of the tape after which he says, I'm not going to do the reenactment, should not have been presented to the jury, was that issue adequately raised to the trial court to preserve it for appeal?
I don't believe it was. And if it had been properly raised at trial court, the state would have been on notice that it was being argued that this was an invocation of the right to remain silent. We would have either redacted redacting the recording has same issues of possibly leading the jury to believe that he may have invoked his right to remain silent based on the law set forth in Domingo.
I'm very confused. How, as to the state's argument that it's not preserved when there was a motion for mistrial on the specific issue during the trial?
And the ICA indicated that it was properly preserved. The issue is properly preserved. I don't think it's improper for the court to consider it. I do think that the court should consider the issue in light of how the issue was preserved. Certainly, if there was the argument that was presented before trial and the state could have properly addressed how to manage the evidence, when it's brought up at trial, the state already has a recording to be put into evidence. The pretrial issues would have already been resolved, and there were no objections at the motion to determine voluntariness.
I thought the motion to determine voluntariness was with respect to specific certain statements within the – was it with respect to the entire recording?
I believe it was with respect to the entire
I thought
recording.
It was with respect to certain statements within the
– But this is an interesting proposition, if I understand you correctly. When a motion for voluntariness is made and the government introduces a statement in the terms of a videotaped interview, like in this case, and the government introduces a videotaped statement, I think knowing what the contents are, right? Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Especially where you've got the burden of proof. And in the, let's assume that in the state, this statement, you have the defendant saying, I'm exercising my right against self-incrimination. I do not want to have my right against self-incrimination violated. But the same thing happens in this case. You just have the defense counsel who hasn't perhaps looked at the tape say that there's an objection and state that it's the burden of the government. So then you proceed to trial, and when it becomes evident, as I've tried to say in the scenario, that the defendant's right against self-incrimination was clearly violated during the statement, you would concede that the government can at that point say, no harm, no foul, because the defendant didn't realize that we were submitting a statement, a videotape that clearly violated the defendant's rights. You wouldn't make that argument, would you? So what's would you?
No, I would not make.
Because this would be a real interesting trick that could be pursued, right? We have a defense counsel, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to be paying attention. Let's go ahead and get before the jury evidence of that's in violation of Fifth Amendment right. But it's okay because then we can later say the defendant was asleep at the switch. And you might be able to make that argument, except that the whole constitutional proposition here is that you've got a citizen in custody in an inherently coercive atmosphere where the government has the duty to prove voluntariness. So when the court, the reviewing court, is looking at it to sort of go through this parsing of the degree to which the issue has been raised might be contrary to the whole point of the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, which is you're actually supposed to be protecting the citizen from the actions of government that would violate the right against self-incrimination. So we wouldn't want to enable a violation by endorsing this kind of trickery.
I agree. And if this was a case where it was a clear invocation of the defendant's right to remain silent, clearly the state should not be producing evidence that is against the defendant's constitutional rights. I don't think this case is that clear.
Mr. Fry, I want to go into one of your theories, which is his statement really supports his defense. And actually, his invocation doesn't necessarily not support his defense. It kind of supports his defense, too. So he's not objecting to it through trial. It actually comes, the whole statement, including his saying he doesn't want to go to the statement, comes in. Defense counsel doesn't say anything, and isn't till the next day, well, they file later. They file a, not but not in court, lets it come in, it's part of my, well, wait a second. Maybe there's a problem here. He did actually say he didn't want to, or maybe he saw the jury kind of like, you know, whatever the reason, the defense counsel's mind has changed somehow. Even if that were true, how does that not still how is that not still a problem for the defendant? Because can or would you say it's waived as long as he eventually brings them? I understand your point of view, like, it's in. You had a chance to object. You didn't even object when it came in. It's not till after your first inkling, the first inkling the judge has that you have a problem with it for invoking his right is after it's already in the next day. Well, how is that still not a problem?
I think it's still a problem. It's still a problem, but to get to that problem, I think you have to get past whether or not the statement was a clear invocation of the defendant's rights. If it is, the state was in error for introducing it, and then the analysis is whether or not that error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt for the trial court to admit it or for the state to introduce it.
Explain how it could be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Specifically, this court in Rodriguez analyzed and set forth the factors on whether or not it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And the three factors that should be analyzed are the extent of the allegedly prejudicial comments made by the witness. So the witness in this case is the defendant. It's the video recording. So you look at what the defendant said, what was his invocation of rights. And we've discussed that he had an alternate theory on why he didn't want to participate in the reenactment. The second factor in Rodriguez is whether an inference of guilt from silence was stressed to the jury. And that's a major distinction between the case at bar and Heard. In Heard, the prosecutors specifically argued that the defendant's invocation of his right to not participate in the reenactment was evidence of his guilt, and that was never presented here. In fact, it's the opposite. Defense counsel argued in opening statements that the defendant went in and he was completely cooperative with his investigation. The state never argued anything relating to the defendant's failure to cooperate, especially and specifically in the reenactment.
The state's argument is that if a statement is omitted in violation of a defendant's right against self-incrimination, as long as the state doesn't argue that with respect to that statement, it's harmless.
No. If a statement is entered against a defendant's right to remain silent, there must be an analysis of whether it's harmless. And one of the factors is the use against the defendant, just one of the three factors. And the third factor, I think it's clear that if a statement is admitted, it's in violation of the defendant's right to remain silent, but that's not the end of the inquiry. There must be a way to balance the prejudice that the defendant incurred. The third factor in Rodriguez is the extent of other evidence suggesting the defendant's guilt. So in this case, you have eyewitness testimony, you have photos of the blood pooling, you have evidence that the defendant went to the bar afterwards and was braggadocious about his conduct. There is a significant amount of other evidence to establish guilt in this case. And
can I ask you about, maybe it would come in under the first factor, and I have to acknowledge that and I'm not 100% sure what was exactly said, because I'm not sure, is there actually a transcript in the record exactly what was said? So let me ask you, based on my understanding, so if I'm wrong, you can correct me. After the defendant said, they asked him if he would go back to the scene, and the officer said, you know, it's up to you, but and the defendant replied that he'd already told everything. He was shaking and scared, didn't want to go back with the guy's friends, and he was afraid for his life. And then he said other things about the guy. And then he says to the officer, actually, after he'd already said, you know, he said he'd already said everything, he asked the officer, would it help the police if he went? Did he ask that question?
I believe he did.
And the officer said, essentially, yeah, it would help provide, I guess, substance to your account. In other words, the officer is asking that this would substantiate your account if you would go do it, okay? And the defendant said he was not comfortable with it, a second invocation. So in other words, what the jury heard was that after he had invoked it, the defendant says, would it help you? And so even at when he gets the officer saying yes, he says, I don't want to do that. So all of a sudden, it looks like a message is being conveyed that this person is not only not willing to help the police, but he's unable and does not want to be in a position of trying to substantiate an account, which apparently the officer, even by asking him to do it, is saying this would provide something to the account. So I think when we have to assess the extent of the prejudice from what occurred, all of that has to be considered.
Yes. And with respect to the transcript reads that the recording was not recorded because the disc is in evidence. So that's...
I understand that's the reason. I have to go and listen. But I just wanted to know if my recitation is more or less...
But the defendant never wavered from his position that he was scared to go back to the scene. It was not that he didn't want to cooperate or he thought it was hard to capture, which was the case in Bird. I can't show you. It's really complicated. His thing is, I'm scared of the defendant. I'm scared of his friends. This is where they hang out. I don't want to go back to that place. And that, wasn't he consistent in that the whole way through that discussion?
He was, and he was scared about the victim's connections. He was very fearful of that. And I think the issue, and it clearly does go into the factor of the allegedly prejudicial comments made, the investigating officer was concerned about the location of the knife. The defense counsel raised this issue of an alleged knife that was missed in the investigation.
But can I ask your help on the way to analyze that? Because I guess first I could ask you, is it clear to you, it seems clear from the record, that Detective Amau says there was no knife involved?
No knife found, correct, yes.
Why is the opinion of the detective that no knife is involved relevant?
Well, I think that it goes to why the detective answered in the affirmative that it would help him. It would help.
Okay, so in a murder case where the defendant is alleging that there was a gun that was used against him, and you can bring a detective in to testify that actually there wasn't a gun. That's your position.
Well, what was the officer's testimony? Did he say there was no knife involved or no knife was found?
There was no knife involved. That was the quote that I have. So let's just assume that this is straightforward, admissible evidence to have a police officer come in and testify about the defense's claim of a weapon. It happened here. Now, would you think that the jury would have in mind when it making a determination of whether there was an assault or an attempted murder, whether there was a knife involved? Would that be important?
I believe it was central to the defendant's claim.
If that's the case, if the jury is thinking, I'd like to know the defendant's story about how the knife was involved, would that be a rational assumption on the part of the jury's determination? They'd probably be interested in the defendant's view of how the knife was used, right?
And the defendant testified in this case at trial, and he made his statement, which was heard.
So would that foreclose the likelihood that when the defendant was asked to actually explain how the knife was used, the defendant said no? Would that factor in, you think, to the jury's consideration of whether the police officer was correct when he said there was no knife involved?
I don't think the characterization of the defendant's election not to participate in the reenactment was so much that he didn't want to participate with police in comparison to saying that he was scared to go back.
Whatever. The question that I'm asking is, regardless of the reason, if the defendant refuses to reenact the scene, isn't that something the jury would notice in the sense that they would like to see the reenactment?
Possibly, but when you analyze the additional factors in Rodriguez...
You mean they would... Okay. If you want to add the other factors, I'm just trying to understand your view about whether the significance of not reenacting it became more important given the fact that you've got the detective who says actually a knife wasn't involved.
There was no knife recovered.
I want to make sure, try to understand when the state believes there's a sufficient assertion of the right to remain silent when a reenactment is requested of a defendant. So if the police say, would you be willing to engage in a reenactment, and the defendant says, I don't want to do that, that would be sufficient? That would be a sufficiently clear assertion of the right to remain silent?
I'm not sure it is an sufficiently clear assertion.
Okay, so if the defendant says, I refuse to do that, I refuse to do a reenactment, is that a sufficiently clear assertion of the right to remain silent?
I think in a case in which a defendant, if there's a bright line rule that's going to be made about a defendant's response to any question, does a defendant have to affirmatively answer this question directly asked of him in order for it to be a voluntary statement? Otherwise, if there's some line drawn where a defendant is not specifically answering the question asked, but he's continuing to speak,
Please just answer my question. If the police ask the defendant, are you willing to do a reenactment? The defendant says, I refuse to do so. Those are the facts of Heard, right? Basically.
Yes.
And you would concede that that is a sufficient assertion of the right against self-incrimination.
Yes.
But if the defendant says, in response by saying, I don't want to do that, I don't want to engage in a reenactment, do you think that is a sufficient assertion of the right against self-incrimination?
I don't think it is. I think in that case there would probably be a follow-up question so you have additional evidence. But if it's not clear that I don't want to do something.
So you're saying I don't want to do that it would not be sufficient. And so therefore you would also argue that I'm not comfortable with that is also not a sufficient assertion of the right to against self-incrimination. I'm assuming that would be your response, because if I don't want to is not enough, then why would I'm not comfortable with it be sufficient?
It may be. Okay. There's probably no probative value that the state should be introducing that a defendant's not comfortable with something.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask you this. Let's say this was like Heard and the defendant had said, I refuse to do it. But the defendant also said, I refuse to do it because I'm scared and I don't want to go back to the scene. Is it the state's position that the reasons why he didn't want to go would still be admissible after he says, I refuse to do it?
I think the argument needs to be properly brought before the trier of fact. And in this case, if a proper motion had been brought, the redacting of the tape
You're ignoring the motion for mistrial. Just as Justice Pollack said, if the court could have denied the motion for mistrial but said, you know what, this portion should not have been admitted, we're going to strike it, I'm going to instruct the jury to disregard it. Right?
So the record show that the defendant requested that leave?
No. Not to my recollection.
The defendant wanted to miss.
That's correct. And
what if you could just take us back to, so there was a voluntariness hearing, and at the voluntariness hearing, did this issue, any issue about the Fifth Amendment issue come up at all? Does the record show that?
The record shows the record from the voluntariness hearing has a pro forma objection filed on behalf of defense. There was a bench conference during that hearing in which defense counsel basically withdrew his objections, and it was determined that those statements were voluntary and coming in. And it's not the state's position that because those statements are voluntary that the defense counsel waived all further objections to the evidence. That's not the state's position, but
that's coming back to the issue of whether there was waiver or not.
Correct. And
is it problematic if we look at Heard but apply the criteria in Rodriguez? Because Heard's a federal case.
For persuasive value, Heard can be looked at and distinguished because the second factor in Rodriguez is certainly is violated clearly in Heard.
Isn't Rodriguez a state case?
Yes. Yes, it was from this court, 2006.
Yeah. So, but does Heard say that you should look at – Heard doesn't say look at these factors. That's what I'm saying. Are we in federal trouble if we invoke state criteria for admitting invocations – or admitting in evidence invocations to remain silent?
In Rodriguez, this court adopted that three-part test.
Right.
From federal authority. I don't have the citation.
I thought Rodriguez was a statutory violation, not a constitutional violation. Statements made during a fitness proceeding. It was violation of a statute, and this court cited to the statute that says that statements made during fitness proceedings are not admissible. And then it engaged in a harmless analysis.
My understanding of Rodriguez was when it was an invocation of the request not to have the AOR recording. There was an AOR statement that was made, and
I'm talking about Domingo.
Domingo was a 704 issue in which they struck out the portion of the document in which they said, "Do you wish to remain silent?" They just struck that out, and there was a clear invocation of the right to remain silent there, and the prejudice is that there was an inferral that the jury could see that was being used against the defendant. The state was trying to use that evidence against the defendant to show that they didn't lack a mental disease in that case. So
could you go ahead and respond to Justice Nakayama's question as to whether or not under the federal constitutional right against self-incrimination, if there's a violation, whether under the federal standard you can engage in this harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis for a federal constitutional violation?
Didn't Heard do that?
I
thought Heard did something like that.
I believe there was some test applied in Heard.
It was a test, but it wasn't the Rodriguez test.
I don't believe it was the same test as Rodriguez.
So in Heard, the court looked at three things, I believe, whether the extent of the comments, whether an inference of guilt from silence is just the jury, the extent of the other evidence. And I believe in Rodriguez, the test we applied was, I think it was the same. The extent of the allegedly prejudicial comments made by the witness, slightly different phrasing, whether an inference of guilt from silence is stressed to the jury, the extent of the other evidence suggesting the defendant's guilt. So in Rodriguez, we cited the same test that appeared to be used in Heard.
Thank you. And I think Heard was clearly in violation of that second prong of the test, and not so in this case.
Thank you very
much for your argument. Thank you. This is the language from Heard. Heard unambiguously invoked his right to silence when the officer requested that he reenact the shooting. Heard responded to the officer's request by saying, among other things, "I don't want to do that, no, I can't, and I don't want to act it out because it's not that clear." I don't see any difference between that and saying, "I'm not comfortable doing this," and giving some reason as to why he's not comfortable not doing it. And I think it's further clarification that the officer understood that to be an invocation because his next comment was no further questions. That's in 13A, State's Exhibit 13A, the disc itself.
What about the three factors in Rodriguez?
Well, first, one was used against defendant. Well, they showed this disc to the jury. I mean, that's certainly using it against the defendant where it's on record and they published this video.
Was that one of the three factors? I thought it was extent of the comments that he made. One, two, the inference of guilt by invocation, and three, extent of other evidence. Weren't those the three factors?
Well, I think that was, I think the state's argument was that in the case they were using, the prosecutor was stating or saying to the jury about the statement.
So apply the three Rodriguez factor from your point of view in this case.
From my point of view, it's no different than some of the prosecutors saying this than showing it to the jury, watching the defendant invoke his constitutional right to not cooperate with the police.
Didn't the statement go into evidence?
I'm sorry?
The recording went into evidence?
Did the recording go into evidence?
Yes.
So the jury had it. So
it's a video disc, 13A.
So the jury could have played it during deliberations?
Yes.
And did anybody say that he was guilty? See, he refused to cooperate. That's evidence of guilt.
Yes. That was played to the jury.
No. Did the government make that argument? Mr. Fry represented to us that the government did not argue in its argument to the jury that the fact that he had declined to answer was an inference that should have been drawn.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I do not know the answer to that question.
And what about the strength of the evidence? What would your response be to Mr. Fry's arguments that the evidence here was strong? There were eyewitnesses, statements at the bar, and other evidence that he cited.
I would go back to the Dominguez case and say, yes, there's no question there's other evidence that the guy was injured. I don't dispute that. But the question then becomes, should he have been convicted of attempted murder or assault? And that's the same issue that came up in Dominguez. And they said that you can't make that decision by allowing this kind of evidence in. So it's up to the jury. The jury might have convicted Mr. Bedeau Close of assault as opposed to attempted murder.
You know, it seems that, so Rodriguez adopted the three-part test, which does appear to be similar to the test in Heard. The extent of the comments, whether an inference of guilt was stressed to the jury, and the extent of other evidence suggesting the defendant's guilt. And that's the test used by federal courts. However, it appears that the test in federal courts is actually much more favorable to the prosecution, because it's if reviewing the facts as a whole, we are able to determine with fair assurance that the judgment was not substantially swayed by the error, we may conclude that the error was harmless. However, our court, in construing constitutional violations under the Hawaii Constitution, has said that, or other errors, has said that if there's a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction, then it's not harmless. So I'm starting to wonder whether our adoption of this three-part test is consistent with that reasonable possibility standard. It seems to be more geared toward a standard that is much more favorable to the prosecution.
Well, I think that's correct, and I think this state has uniformly adopted that if the evidence might possibly be, then it's not harmless error.
I'm still confused as to how the statement that he was afraid to, he didn't want to give a statement. I mean, I don't want to go back there. I don't want to reenact it. I'm frightened. His friends are there. How does that sway a jury more towards murder than assault?
Well, I can't say it definitely. You know, I can't say
no,
I can pinpoint
it. You don't have to say it definitely, but how could it possibly?
Well, because it would show that he didn't want to cooperate with the police to reenact what the police wanted him to do, and presumably or arguably the jury could then see, if he went back and did the reenactment, they could see evidence of what was actually going on as opposed to what the state was claiming. So that
well,
to that extent,
main,
it could have gone to.
Wasn't the main question whether Mr. Ault came at him with a knife?
That was part
that
of
was the
question,
main
that
thing,
was part right? of his self-defense.
Right,
yes.
He came at me. I didn't know who he was. I'd never seen him before. I didn't recognize him. He came at me with a knife.
Yes.
So you're...
That's partly... Well, that went. He did argue self-defense also, so that would have gone to that argument. And maybe it would have helped him. But the question really is, if the jury sees the defendant in full color, voice, everything, saying, I'm not going to cooperate with the police, I don't think that's constitutionally permitted. Mr. Chief Justice, you had a question earlier. You asked me about, was there a case that said that this balancing act must be on the record? Yeah, and there is one. It's a federal case, and I cited it. I'm sorry I didn't remember it earlier, but it's on page 7 of my application for writ, and it's U.S. versus LeMay, 260 F. 3rd, 1018, 9th Circuit, at page 1031, and it says the holding that the best way for a district court to balance these competing interests is to conduct the Rule 403 analysis on the record, carefully considering each of the factors and others as necessary.
That's, we haven't addressed that issue yet here in Hawaii, though, to your knowledge.
Okay. No, I understand this is a federal case.
Very well. Anything else you wanted to raise with the court at this time, Mr. Cox?
I don't think so. Thank you.
Very well. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thanks both of our attorneys for your arguments.
Thank you for your time.